May it please the court, Max Walton on behalf of Appellant Swanky Civic Association. At stake in this appeal is whether Justice Hartnett's 1985 class action order relating to the Swan Keys development allows the community to adopt, by a majority vote, reasonable rules and regulations applicable to individual lots. The current regulations, the ones that are in dispute here, were adopted in 1995 under the direction of now Judge Stokes when he was the attorney for the association. He was also the attorney for the association in a class action suit. Judge Stokes relied upon the 1985 order in adopting those regulations. It's our position that there's nothing in the 1985 order that limits the ability of the community to adopt rules and regulations by a majority vote, and the Court of Chancery's decision below holding that the rules and regulations language applies only to the common areas should be reversed. Excuse me. The purpose of that 1985 class action order was to get a global resolution for the Swan Keys development and what Justice Hartnett described as a nightmare of real estate law. And page 9 of that order gives us the language that is in dispute in this case. And that language contains no statement whatsoever, that the rules and regulations authority is limited to the common areas, as the court below held. There is simply nothing in that order that limiting to the common areas, the rules and regulations clause to the common areas. And if there were any question of whether or not that language was intended to apply to common areas, Justice Hartnett used the phrase common area, common property, several times earlier in the order. And the addition of the common area language by the court below in the rules and regulations clause should be reversed.
Why would the Vice Chancellor Hartnett not include the restrictive covenant language that had been worked out by the parties in the agreement? And if I accept your argument, in essence, allow a totally unrestrictive covenant by agreement of 50% of the landowners. Isn't that inconsistent? And then wouldn't it be a more fair reading that he wasn't willing to put in the restrictive covenants that would include something as you're suggesting here?
Your Honor, a couple of points. First, the parties agreed that the only restrictive covenant at issue in this case is the 1985 order. And my view is that Justice Hartnett's language adopting rules and regulations is a lot smarter than I was, because he wanted to have a system where the community would be in charge of the rules and regulations and what governed, and it could be changed. And as far as the earlier settlement agreement, he didn't want to impose a set of deed restrictions by court order. Certainly today, in modern times, there are deed restrictions that have, you can modify them with 75 or 80% of the people within the community, and that's how you modify. But at that time, that wasn't nearly as common, so he adopted the rules and regulations language to put the authority to govern the community in the hands of the community. And going back to the language that he used, he did not use common areas. He very well could have, but did not. And because he didn't use the common area language, the intent, the objective intent of the instrument that he wrote shows that he did not intend the rules and regulations to apply only to those common areas. Again, he could have made that limitation, but did not. And if there was any question, I think, regarding what the intent was or what was done in the court below, because there are some that was done in 1985. If there were any questions, I think that's best answered by Judge Stokes's letters that were in the record. It was Judge Stokes's interpretation that the community could adopt exactly what they did here, both in 1987 and in 1985, and we submit that that's the best evidence of the intent of the court and what happened below. And also, to your other point, Judge Carpenter, I would submit that as far as the regulations that were in the the language that was in the settlement agreement and the language that ended up in the order, that was sort of a compromise a position, because certainly the settlement agreement said they were going to adopt rules, or excuse me, restrictive covenants, and this was the way to sort of finalize a global resolution of all of the nightmare of the Swan Keys development in real estate law.
Or it could reflect that Justice Hartnett believed that imposing the restrictive covenants that potentially would be agreed to by the parties wasn't appropriate in the class action that was being litigated.
In some respects, I think that's right. I think ultimately, though, Your Honor, he wanted to leave that authority to govern with the community in reaching that global resolution, and he didn't want, frankly, a set of restrictions drafted by Judge Stokes to be put in by court order. Instead, Justice Hartnett really wanted to put that in the hands of the community to make rules and regulations and put the power in the ballot box of the people in who they elected to the association as president and to govern and what rules and regulations they adopted.
Well, can you identify where the vice chancellor's analysis went awry based on your argument?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where did the vice chancellor get it wrong then? He's looking at the same language you are, and he's coming to a different conclusion. You make it sound like it would be unreasonable, as you should as an advocate,
thank you,
unreasonable to come to any conclusion other than your own. But he came to a different conclusion. How did he get it wrong?
I think that the court below did not focus on the plain language of the rules and regulations clause, but went ahead and added language which he thought might have been intended, because there certainly wasn't any testimony, for example, from Justice Hartnett or even Judge Stokes, for that matter. There wasn't any testimony on that order. And he put in language of what he thought the order might have intended, but that violated the rule of the plain language, and you get your intent of the document from the plain language of the words that are used. And the words that were used here didn't limit the association's authority to adopt rules and regulations only to the common areas. And you're right, Your Honor, it's a very simple and straightforward argument, and I think that the court below got it wrong. One of those reasons...
Can I look at it slightly differently? As I understand it, the trial court said, okay, we've got to go back to what happened in that class action, right?
And yes.
And the class action had to do with forming an organization to take care of the common areas, correct?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And there was nothing, if I'm not missing something, there was nothing in that original class action that dealt with putting in height restrictions or fence restrictions or dog restrictions or anything else,
agreed,
right?
Agreed, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. So we start out with a dispute over the formation of an organization to deal with common areas, and that's number one. Then number two, at least according to the trial court here, in that class action, Justice Hartnett was concerned that before any changes get made that affect the land, everybody who owns property there has to be given notice. And then we look at what the notice was, and there again, the notice talks strictly about the need to have or addressing issues relating to the common areas. So how does either one of those facts support a conclusion that the result of that litigation was authority to do more than deal with the common areas?
Two things, Your Honor. Number one, if you look at, it's actually in Appendix B23, which is the original notice. The original notice, while it doesn't deal with common areas, the original notice of the class action doesn't deal with common areas specifically, but it does advise the parties that they would be members of the class and that they will, quote, will receive the benefit of a favorable determination and will be bound by an adverse determination. It also talks about them getting their own counsel and reviewing. If you move forward in the litigation, and this is what was not focused on by the court below, is that the rules and regulation language was in the settlement, notice of settlement and a settlement hearing that went forward in front of Vice Chancellor Hartnett. And the parties certainly had notice, and the class action members had notice, because there were 804 letters that went out, and it's right in the first part of the final order of the Court of Chancery in 1985,
What are you suggesting then, that when this case, the class action case, was settled at a settlement hearing, there was discussion of the idea that this settlement would allow for restrictions on individual property owners' property?
That's correct. The notice, if you look within the record in the court's order, the 1985 order, it was actually mailed out to all the parties. There was a notice of posting in the paper and that sort of thing. And the parties had, and everybody within the class received notice of exactly this language.
Right.
Yes.
But what I'm getting at is that they received notice of language that said rules and regulations. Did they receive notice of, or at the hearing, was there discussion of that would include more than just common areas? It would include the ability to, restrict your property.
I am sorry, Your Honor, that I cannot comment on what was stated at the hearing. I know the parties below, which I wasn't involved with, tried mightily to obtain a transcript of what happened at the hearing, and no transcript could be found. So I cannot make any representation on that point.
All right. And with respect to the notice of the settlement, all you have is that there's a notice that says we're going to settle it and that there are going to be rules and regulations.
Yes, the notice, or there's notice of the order. Okay, and the best evidence, Your Honor, I would submit, of what happened, or who was in the best position to know what occurred, was Judge Stokes. And Judge Stokes's letter made to the association made it very clear that that the community could adopt rules and regulations, number one. And two, it was a portion of the settlement agreement dealing with restrictive covenants, which was also sent out. And then when we dealt with the rules and regulations language in the final order, they also had that, they had that notice, or the parties had that notice. So in the settlement agreement, there was some notification, and also in the notice of the order.
Okay, but again, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're asking us to conclude is that by giving notice that this settlement would allow for the formation of rules and regulations without any discussion of what those rules and regulations might cover, we are supposed to infer from that that rules and regulations went beyond just rules and regulations governing the common areas.
That yes, Your Honor, because the term common areas wasn't used in the limitation language. And because folks had notice of that, and if someone wanted to clarify that as part of the class, they had the opportunity to do that in a settlement hearing, but no one did that. There wasn't an objection here. So, yes, my point is that because the rules and regulations language is not limited to the common areas alone, that means that Justice Hartnett did not intend to have rules and regulations apply only to the common areas, which is what Vice Chancellor Strine held in this case.
If I understood your argument after reading the specific language of that I would suggest is relevant, that comes from the attempted new list of restrictive covenants that the parties agreed on and referred to binding all the property owners of Swan Keys to a set of restrictions subject to the approval of the court. That language doesn't say a set of restrictions on the common areas. That language is missing. And you're suggesting that the parties intended that all owners would be subject to these restrictions, that the parties wish to be subject to the approval of the court. But Justice Hartnett concluded that making them subject to the approval of the court was onerous, so he refused to agree to that and instead set out three points: that everybody's going to be a member of the association, they have a right to elect members to the board, they'll be assessed for past dues, special fees to effectuate conveyances of the common areas and maintenance fees in the future. But then there's other language in the final judgment that talks about, upon approval by the majority of the lot owners, the rules and regulations shall bind and be enforceable upon all the lot owners of Swan Keys. Again, with no limiting language to the common areas, correct?
Correct.
So all he's saying, you're arguing, is that I'd object to the part of the party's settlement that deals with the court being forever subject to approving these rules and regulations that ought to be done by a majority of the lot owners.
That's my position, yes, Your Honor.
And those of us who practiced in front of Vice Chancellor Hartman are not unfamiliar with him changing all the orders that are submitted that the parties agree to. But that's as far as you would read it.
I would say that, yes, that's as far as I would go, because he used particular language in this clause, in the rules and regulations clause. You're talking about the settlement agreement, but in the final order, he used very particular language. When he used common areas in other parts of the order,
It's the absence of the continued reference to restrictions applying to common areas only, to rules and regulations applying to common area.
Yes,
because that's gone, because that's not there. We should infer that he was just modifying slightly what the parties had submitted to him.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're in your rebuttal time already.
I'm in my rebuttal time, and I will address the attorney's fee issue on rebuttal if it comes.
Well, you'll be able to if they bring it up. If they don't bring it
just
up.
Just quickly,
you're
Your
done.
Honor, on that, since I'm into my rebuttal time, the attorney's fee issue is governed by an abuse of discretion standard, and the court below did not abuse their discretion by saying that by reducing the fees for two-thirds relating to claims for what the court below deemed claims of questionable utility.
Okay.
Sit down.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dean Campbell. I represent the homeowners Barbara Shamp, John, and Judith Humphreys. Would the court care for a recitation of the facts or clarification of any factual issues?
No, I think it'd be, unless someone has a question, I think it'd be more helpful to focus on the language of this, of the first, the supposed agreement of the parties, and then the way in which Vice Chancellor Hartnett changed the order, and where are we now?
Certainly.
Vice Chancellor Strine's ruling.
If I can, before going there, I would like to clear up one issue. There was a representation made in the appellant's argument that the notice specifically told the individuals what the settlement agreement was. We don't have any record of that, and there's nothing in the record to demonstrate that. All we know is that there was notice given. If you look at paragraph 3 of the court's order, you'll see it acknowledges that notice was given, but we don't know what the notice said. The only notice we have of the class action was the initial notice that went out at the initiation of the class action litigation, which didn't reference any changes to rules and regulations, didn't reference any restrictive covenants, didn't reference anything except the fact that if the relief sought by the plaintiffs was granted, then what they would be forced with was creating a homeowners association and paying for the common areas. And that is in the record. It's paragraph 9 of the other notice that was included in the briefing. The appellants make an argument that these are rules and regulations that are being enforced. But when we look at the law, and all of us being attorneys, we recognize that in real property law, you have certain servitudes that carry with the land, that run with the land. And in those are included such things as easements, licenses perhaps, and restrictive covenants. I'm not sure from the briefing, I'm still not sure what position the appellants take on exactly what it is that's running with the land. It appears from their briefing at times they're saying that this homeowners association essentially has the right to create what are essentially zoning ordinances. But the law makes it clear that when you cross the line onto telling individuals what they can do with their real property, the standard goes up. And we see that in some of the issues or some of the cases I brought up or authorities I brought up in the briefing was Powell on real property, restatement third of property. Even cases from this court talk about, you know, there's a heightened standard here. It has to be clear. It has to be exact. Explicit written language is the language from the Leon Werner case.
What does it have to be? What do you mean by it?
The restrictive covenants, what it is that runs with the land has to be expressed very clearly. In this particular case, we're faced with the changing of the settlement agreement from restrictive covenants to rules and regulations. And what the appellant is arguing is essentially speculation at this point. Why did Vice Chancellor Hartnett change that? We know from Judge Stokes' letter that the Vice Chancellor did not accept any restrictive covenants. We also know from Betty Bozzi, who was a park manager, stating facts from Judge Stokes, that he had repeatedly told them, you cannot establish restrictive covenants. And if you look at Judge Stokes' letter, it doesn't say what the appellant wanted to say. It simply says that there is other relief available. Excuse me. So, and furthermore, we would submit, and all due respect to Judge Stokes, at the time this was going on, this litigation back in the 1980s in Follinet, he was a private attorney. He had no authority at that point and was trying to get his clients from point A to point B as best he could. I don't believe you will find anywhere in any of his letters where he advises the association that they can pass restrictive covenants. So the association has not answered what it is they've created other than the rules and regulations. And interestingly enough, the appellant's position has also changed drastically. Vice Chancellor Strine, and I'm moving now to the 1995 restrictive covenants that are issued. Vice Chancellor Strine clearly discussed those as being restrictive covenants. And the reason he did that was many reasons. Number one, that's what they are. They satisfy the initial requirements, touching and certain land, passed to successor parties in interest. And the association even tried to give notice. So all the elements are there.
Are we dealing here with a language exchange that wasn't careful? I mean, the agreement that was submitted to then Vice Chancellor Hartnett referred to a set of restrictions subject to the approval of the court. And we know he rejected whatever that phrase set of restrictions meant being subject to the approval of the court. And then in his final judgment, he says, rules and regulations that shall bind and be enforceable upon all the lot owners or heirs, executors, successors, and assigns. That sounds like restrictive covenant language, although the phrase rules and regulations are used. Is this a meaningful difference in terminology?
Well, absolutely. I think the distinction here is, in this particular case, we are dealing with learned jurists. Vice Chancellor Hartnett, of course, at that time on the Chancery Court, came to this court. Judge Stokes, Mel Monzak, all very experienced attorneys. And the question needs to be answered, why, if they meant to say something that comports to be rules and regulations, or if they meant to say restrictive covenants, why do they say rules and regulations? It just doesn't make sense. But the other ambiguity that exists in that paragraph is the part about the operation of Swan Keys. As Vice Chancellor Strine found, if you take that phrase, the operation of Swan Keys, it makes sense talking about the common areas. Obviously, the association should have that right to operate the common areas. We even argued below that that may even refer to Swan Keys, the association, the corporate body, would have the right to make rules and regulations. Those are two very clear possibilities. But when you take that operate Swan Keys and apply that to private property, the phrase just does not make any sense. They are going to operate someone else's private property from the association? Why would they do that? Why would Vice Chancellor Hartnett even allow that? If he disallowed restrictions to be inserted into the court order and make them binding upon every lot, then why would he allow the association to have such unfettered control that they can make rules and regulations by a simple majority vote? And in particular, when we were in oral arguments in Chancery, Vice Chancellor Strine asked the association's attorney, you know, at what point do these rules and regulations end? You know, what do they govern and where do they stop, was essentially his question. And he took that from one extreme to the other and finally ended up, can the association regulate chewing gum? A ridiculous example, of course. Association's attorney answered, well, under this theory, probably so. answered yes.
Well, whatever he may have said hyperbolically and whatever the association's attorney may have agreed to, look at Judge Stokes's letter, and admittedly, he wasn't Judge Stokes at the time, whatever difference that makes. He talks about the order allowing reasonable rules and regulations for the operation of Swan Key, subject to approval of majority of the lot owners. Then he says the association should develop a set of rules and obtain majority approval. Then he says, and I think this is significant in terms of what he thought the order meant, absent this, the county rules would apply insofar as setbacks and similar matters are concerned. That certainly reads as if he was contemplating the kind of restrictive covenants, the kind of limitations on construction and modification of property that would be similar to zoning rules and have nothing to do with this hyperbolic chewing gum or dogs or cats or anything else.
The problem that we face is we know that Judge Stokes at the time was acting as advocate. We knew that he had been involved in litigation. There's really nothing in the record that shows that he reviewed what was eventually passed, first of all. Secondly, that reference to height restrictions or setbacks or whatever could also very easily pertain to the common areas just as well, because the county ordinances would apply to the common areas just as they apply to private property.
But he says the rules and regulations shall bind and be enforceable on all the lot owners of Swan Keys, and then their heirs, executors, successors, and assigns. How do you restrict that to the common areas?
Well, the main thing there to focus on, and this is Justice Berger's question a few moments ago, is what this litigation was about. This litigation was not about private property, and what Vice Chancellor Strine here, and certainly Vice Chancellor Hartnett back in 1985 was concerned about, was due process. What notice have we given? And in this particular case, and I understand you're looking at Judge Stokes' letter, and again, with all due respect to him, Judge Stokes is not the one that authored the court order.
No, but he is part of the author of the agreed court judgment that was submitted to Vice Chancellor Hartnett, and that referred to binding all the property owners to a set of restrictions. Now, he follows it up after the order is issued, explaining that you can pass rules and regulations which are tantamount to restrictions, similar to county rules that affect setbacks and similar matters. Now, it's not like he wasn't at the table when that original language was submitted or wasn't there when Vice Chancellor Hartnett modified it, but he certainly left the table apparently thinking that this was more than just the common areas that were affected.
And he very well may have thought that to be the case, and I'm certainly not insinuating that he was telling us a falsehood or something like that. But to take that extreme approach, I mean, there is in place centuries of real property law that deal with how you put restrictions on someone's property, how to properly go about implementing these types of servitudes. It goes back to the 1500s in the Shelley's case and forward. These rules and regulations that the association now says they're enforcing are restrictive covenants. No matter how you look at them, they affect real property. That was even the appellant's position in the court below. This case in particular was filed pursuant to 10 Delaware Code 348, which deals with enforcement of deed restrictions. Throughout the record below, from the complaints through the motions practice for temporary restraining orders, through the briefing, and even into oral arguments, the association before argued we are enforcing restrictive covenants. We're not enforcing rules and regulations. We're enforcing restrictive covenants. Now, however, that focus has changed, and they've changed what they call them. But when you get right down to it, what they are enforcing are deed restrictions, restrictions on the use of real property. And by creating this subcategory of rules and regulations and saying that they bind all the property and all the property owners, we are creating, and I would submit to you, if this court affirms or reverses, you are approving a new classification of servitude, a real property servitude, called Rules and Regulations Running with the Land. That is what the argument is here today. And I would submit that that is not something this court or Vice Chancellor Hartnett had in mind. And the other thing is, Vice Chancellor Hartnett knew restrictive covenants and knew how to bind restrictive covenants to the land. He wrote about it in 1984 in the Chambers case. He wrote about it in 1993 in the Point Farms case. And in his language, he spoke specifically about if a restrictive covenant is to be implemented, it is to be clear, precise, and not unreasonable. If this court believes that what he was intending was to make these rules and regulations apply in in rem fashion to the real property, then I think this court ignores everything Vice Chancellor Hartnett wrote about how they are to be clear.
What do you mean by interim fashion?
I'm sorry?
You used the phrase, if he intended to have them imposed in interim fashion. What does that mean?
If I said interim, I misspoke. But what I mean, or what I meant to say was in any fashion. If we attach these rules and regulations to the land, they become deed restrictions.
Right.
Pure and simple. And if he intended to do that, why would he have not made that much clearer? The other thing that
this goes beyond, I guess you would also argue that any passage of setback limitations that are inconsistent with the county code, any requirement to maintain the bulkhead, things of that, that's all that the association could not do either.
Well, I'm not exactly sure of the bulkhead, because the bulkhead may be on common ground. I'm not positive of that. With respect to setbacks and height restrictions, absolutely. Powell on real property, Professor Powell, designates affirmative restrictions and negative restrictions. Anything that tells a property owner how they cannot use their property is a negative deed restriction. And that is where it crosses the line. We don't dispute that the association has the ability to regulate the common areas or to regulate the association or pass rules and regulations that pertain to that. But once it crosses that line,
well, they have passed regulations that said you can't have a recreation vehicle that's occupied by someone else on the land. Now, that doesn't involve the common areas. That's persons parked their vehicle. Does that go too far?
Well, Your Honor, if we look at modern day restrictive covenants, I mean that is something you find regularly in these types of covenants. Again, they're telling the individuals what they can do on and off their real property. This was the problem in Swan Keys, and is still the problem today. When the homeowners association or neighbors take control of property rights, that becomes a completely different category of dispute that becomes into the law of restrictive covenants.
Can deed restrictions. I yes. ask you a hypothetical? Let's assume that at some point now or in the past, it doesn't matter when, all the homeowners of this area of Swan Keys are given notice and they agree to allow a vote of 50% or 51% of the homeowners to set restrictive covenants for everyone. Or for anyone, but basically give that authority away. Is that something that would be valid and enforceable moving forward? So I'm currently a homeowner. I vote yes, I'm going to allow our civic association by majority vote to set restrictive covenants. Mm-hmm. And I sell my house 5 years from now. New owner is subject to it. It runs with the land. Is that valid and enforceable?
Well, first of all, from your question, I understand that 100% of the homeowners permit this restrictive covenant to go forward. The agreement to allow...
They agree to give the authority to a vote of 51% of the homeowners.
That, in fact, would become a restrictive covenant. If the owner of Lot B agrees with that and is agreeable to putting that restrictive covenant on their property, then that becomes a restrictive covenant they've agreed to, and as long as it's properly recorded, that would pass on to successors. However,
okay, even though we wouldn't know what the restrictive covenant is, because today the Civic Association hasn't adopted any, but tomorrow the Civic Association says all houses have to be set back 20 feet, and 6 months from now there's a new restrictive covenant, but whatever it is, it then becomes part of my deed and moves forward with my land.
That restrictive covenant that they have just created, allowing neighbors to make decisions about their property, is in fact a restrictive covenant. So yes, that would become enforceable,
okay,
as long as this particular homeowner agree with it, because they are asserting rights to their own property. I would like to finish up, I'm almost out of time, with one thought in particular. The association has argued strenuously throughout this appeal that the court should look at the four corners of the document, and the document says what it says, and if the vice chancellor had meant to put the words in of common areas, he would have done so. The language that's in question in this case, of course, is upon a majority of the lot owners, board of directors may recommend reasonable rules and regulations for the operation of Swan Keys. The operation of Swan Keys is really the section that's a question along with the rules and regulations. They've asserted that pertains to everything, including the private lots, not just the common areas. The very next page, in the middle of the page, the second paragraph, there's a section that says, without limitation, and may I finish my thought?
Yes,
thank you. Without limitation, the association shall, through its board of directors, propose a budget for approval by a majority of the lot owners for the maintenance, repair, and operation of Swan Keys. Well, if you follow appellant's logic, that same operation of Swan Keys passes over to the next page, which obligates the Homeowners Association to maintain and repair 603 lots in perpetuity. It just doesn't make sense.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to focus on the purpose of the 1985 order. In that 1985 order, you had a nightmare of real estate law that was created by these different deeds and different lots. And the purpose I would submit to the court of that order was to come up with a way that the community would govern its standards. And that's what the court, Justice Hartnett, did with the 1985 order and the rules and regulations language. We've talked a lot today, and there's been a lot of talk about restrictive covenants. And the restrictive covenant here is the 1985 order, because that's where you have the authority. And to your question, Your Honor, in many communities, you start with a general tract of land, and the initial owner puts them in, puts the restrictions on and moves forward in development. But in this case, the court came up with language to allow the community to establish the rules and regulations. And in our view, there is nothing in the rules and regulations language that limits the association, the majority owners, to adopt regulations only for the common areas. There's nothing in there. So it had to mean something else. Because there was no limitation in the common area or restricting this to the common area, we believe that the courts below erred in its decision, and we request that it be reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.